Welcome to your first class on great speeches and documents, 1689 to 2022. Okay, so that's sitting there, lots of time. And you have here volume one of the documents in question. Volume two is the next one. And there's no volume three. It's just two volumes, okay. And so we're going to be looking at one every week. So do try to read at least some of the document beforehand, but there won't be a test. It's not my problem. It's your problem. Okay. So good news and bad news. The bad news is that these documents are quite long. And the first ones are very difficult because they're the 17th century, the 18th century. Whereas they will get, actually, the English will get easier, because when you get to Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela, well, they speak modern, so they're a little easier. So that's the bad news. The good news is that we're going to visit some really quite impressive people over the centuries, and with a bit of luck we're going to... Not me, but you. We're going to learn more about British history and the big themes of what came up. Just as in previous semesters, if you need information, if the room changes or if I am ill or dead, the information will be up here. Yes, it's the same jokes every semester. Yeah. Okay. So that's where you get it. I would also put up there the PowerPoint slides, and if the technology works, also the recording, so that in case you miss a class, or if you forget everything, then you might want to listen to it again, or give it to your boyfriend or girlfriend if you want them to leave you. Can I have everybody signing in here to say that you are present? If you just sign in there, and I will pretend to take notice of that. So what I'm going to do today is, first of all, I'm going to look at all 12 characters to give you a taster, and then I'm going to go and plunge into John Locke, the philosopher who wrote the letter on toleration, and I hope give you some chances to understand that. So the 12 people we're going to be looking at is, first of all, John Locke, from the 17th century, English philosopher from the Enlightenment. In French, you say le siècle des Lumières, 100 years, no more. The Enlightenment is a very general term for this period when more and more sections of the elite were saying, hey, perhaps all the truth is not in the Bible. Perhaps the church isn't the only source of authority. Let's have a look back at Plato and Aristotle and Hippocrates, and let's see what they have to say. And let's study and let's raise the importance of science. This is the period where in France, l'Académie des Sciences est fondée à la fin du 17e. In England, the Royal Academy of Science. Science is a rising thing. It's very, very slow, and it certainly does not mean that people abandon religion. But nevertheless, the power of religion is and the power of science is going up very, very slowly. So an Enlightenment philosopher from Britain. Now, obviously, somebody thought he was very important because they made a bust of him. He should have been beautiful marble busts, Nobody has made a marble bust of me, so I guess I'm not important enough yet. But just wait, just a little bit longer. Oh, I should say that this is my last semester. I'm retiring at the end of this semester. You're supposed to say, "Oh, but you look much too young." Thank you, thank you. So the result is I can say what I like, because they can't do anything to me now. Okay. In the second week, we will be looking at Thomas Paine, who is a fun guy. He was born in Thetford, England. Thetford is a very small, I think the French expression is un trou perdu, somewhere in near Norwich, I think. And he was quite an impressive guy. As you can see, he lived in the 18th century, 1736 to 1809. And if you, I'm sure your century is good enough to, American Revolution, French Revolution, that's the one. And so Thomas Paine, who was born I think his father was a corset maker, who made corsets. So a very ordinary guy, and he went to America, and he became an important writer for the American Revolution, saying, "Leave Britain. We don't want a king. We don't want control from Britain. We want a new kind of society in America." And he was friends with, you know, like George Washington and Madonna. No, not Madonna. George Washington and people like that. Then he came back to England. And a few years later, he came to France because there was a revolution in France. Oh, I don't want to miss that. And he became a member of the National Assembly in France, even though he didn't speak French. Okay, so so I'll be telling you some of this story. And he wrote books which were bestsellers and which were banned, which were censored. Yeah, he was considered a dangerous writer by the elites of the time. So that's the person we'll be looking at in week number two. In week number three, then perhaps you can see fairly immediately here, actually, because this gentleman, Thomas Paine, the revolutionary, first of all, you can see his statue, which is rather informal in style. Yeah, he stops looking noble and so on. And also, it's in a small town where he was born. Whereas the next gentleman here, you can see, first of all, he is looking much more posh. He's looking much more posh, and he needs all this to it. It's probably in Latin and stuff. And his statue is in Trinity College, Cambridge, yes. Probably the most prestigious university in the country. This is Thomas Babington Macaulay. He was a politician, the 19th century politician. He was a Whig, the two big parties, the Whigs and the Tories. Now, remember, this is not a democracy. Only rich people can vote at this time, yeah? And the Tories in general defend the landowners, and the Whigs in general defend industry. The new capitalists, the new factory owners and so on, because this is at that time. And so we will be looking at a speech that he gave when the Parliament was saying, maybe instead of only very rich men voting, we could have all rich men voting. You know, this was the big debate in 1832, and he will give his opinion and what he thinks about that. And that is quite delightful. The next one, it's probably my favourite one. When I was in Washington, D.C., I've been very lucky with my job. I can travel to lots of places. And I saw his house. He's dead, yeah, but his house is still there. And this is Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, when he was born, he was a slave. He was born into slavery. And he managed to run away and become a free man. Now, I don't know about you, but if I was a slave and then I run away and was free, I would then hide away so nobody could find me. But he didn't do that. He became a political leader and was in great danger of being taken back by his master. So he was an extremely brave gentleman who, like I say, I would have hidden under the table for 50 years or something. But no, this was a guy who went forward. And the document we're going to look at is an article he wrote, which was a letter to my former master. He really wrote a real letter to the person who owned him previously. It's got a certain class to it. And we're then going to go back to Britain for the beginning of the 20th century, and we're going to look at the most famous of the suffragettes, Emmeline Pankhurst. Here she is. She's relatively young. She will become more well known as she gets older. She died in 1928, just before women got votes on the same basis as men. And that's what she did, and she did other things as well, as we shall explain. We're still talking about her today, because here we have a statue of her, which was erected in 2018, just 5 years ago. They put up a new statue of her, so she hasn't been forgotten. So that's something, that's Emmeline Pankhurst. I should say, and I think you will not be surprised to hear, that all of these people and all of these documents are more complicated than you think. Yeah. In fact, in general, university is supposed to make you think, oh, it's more complicated than I thought. That's our job. And usually we succeed in doing that. If we're lucky, we don't demoralize you in the process. Emmeline Pankhurst then, fighting for women's suffrage, and the first woman on our list, because as I'm sure you're aware, for most of the 17th, 18th and 19th century, politics, philosophy and public life was not really open to women. Yeah, they had to force their way in, but mostly the most influential people were men. Let's go back to the United States of America and look at one of the big capitalists of the end of the 19th century, Andrew Carnegie. He was born in Scotland. He was a big hero of the new capitalist class, an entrepreneur, made millions. And he was also a philanthropist. That is, he gave a lot of his money away. And his particular philanthropic campaign was to build libraries. He said that working class people need libraries. This is before there were free libraries everywhere. And he established across the world, but mostly in Britain and America, a couple of thousand, I can't remember, I'll tell you when I get the numbers, free libraries. And this is a Carnegie Library. And I have a little link to this, because this library is 200 meters from my mother's house another trou perdu in the north of England. So I have a personal link to this guy, although, of course, you will not be surprised to hear, he is more complicated than you think. Moving on again, we're staying mostly at the turn of the century, the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, and we're going to look at a president of the United States of America. Can you help me here? A president at the end of the 19th century in America, in the United States? You got an idea? Lincoln is earlier, I think. I'm not good at this, but that's the guy, yeah, I think. Yes, yeah. Now, of course, perhaps you remember there are two Roosevelts, yeah? Which one do we want? Thank you. Oh, geez, yeah, Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy to his friends, who bizarrely enough, is actually the origin of the teddy bear. But he did other things as well, okay, which is good. Theodore Roosevelt, did you see? Here he looks like... it's incredible face, really, the moustache and so on. It looks like he's going somewhere. United States politician and 26th president of the United States. And he no doubt established, there was a very old parody history book I read when I was young, and it said, after this, the United States became top nation. Roosevelt was president when the United States became number one power in the world, and perhaps you noticed it is still number one today, just from a power point of view. And so he was the sign of that. You can see here a statue of the gentleman on a horse. Who are these people? Well, you're a bit far. You may move if you will. Okay. Who are these people here? This is a Native American, or of course, when Roosevelt was around, they said an Indian. Yeah, and who's this? Yeah, an African. Well, just an African, I think. Yeah, more just an African. Yeah, or perhaps an African American. And you can see that he's the boss, and these are people who he's looking after. Yeah, it's not generally a 21st century vision of the world. A very traditional vision of the world. Look how happy they are to be supporting Teddy Roosevelt. And this statue was recently removed. It was in the center of town. I'll tell you when, I can't remember. And now it is in a museum somewhere. Because, as you know, statues have become an important focus for who do we want to glorify in the public place. Yeah, ideas are changing. Of course, people do not agree, which is wonderful, but things are changing. The next gentleman who we're looking for, yes, it's still a gentleman, is the only one who is not British or American. And this is but extremely well known, which is Nelson Mandela. And we're going to look at the speech he gave in the trial. Does anybody know the name of the trial? Ça commence à faire longtemps maintenant. The trial, yeah, he had a trial when he was, he thought he was going to get executed. But, spoiler, he wasn't executed. You knew, didn't you? He wasn't executed. The Rivodia trial. En fait, quand j'avais votre âge, l'Afrique du Sud, tout le monde parlait que d'Afrique du Sud. Comme aujourd'hui Gaza, à l'époque c'était l'Afrique du Sud, tout le monde s'y connaissait avec un avis d'un côté ou de l'autre. And so here we have Nelson Mandela, South African activist and later president of South Africa. And you can see here a photograph of him when he was young. And here you can see a photograph of him when he was older. Between the two, you will not find any photographs because he was in prison for 27 years and incommunicado almost all the time. Yeah, so it's like there was a missing... Okay, there were worse things about the prison than not having a collection of your photographs. Yeah, but yeah, there were even worse things about that. I'm just being flippant. So we're going to look at his speech in the Rivonia trial. That's right. Yes. Let's keep moving. Again, back to the United States. These are some of the many of these people are extremely well known or extremely famous. However, you're probably not used to looking at in detail at what they said and how quite complicated it could be sometimes. So the next one, you'll be unsurprised to hear Martin Luther King assassinated in 1968 when he was very young, a Baptist minister. And you can see here, this is a statue of him in Washington, D.C., it is enormous. Unfortunately, I didn't put anybody next to it for the style. It's enormous. But also, it's a little bit strange. He appears to be walking out of the rock. Wow. Yeah? Like a sort of god figure, in a way. Yes, a very, very modern, relatively modern style, you know. Not a classical statue. And perhaps you know that every year, in the United States, they have a holiday, Martin Luther King Day. Back to Britain. The first woman Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. 1979, she became Prime Minister. And she was... tremendously important in the neoliberal changes of the 1980s, which became extremely influential further on. In fact, our French president said a few years ago, he said, "I want to be the French Thatcher." Yeah? So we can see that she's still, people have not forgotten her. Yeah? She's still very much a present figure. And here you can see a statue of Margaret Thatcher. And there are two interesting things about it. Three. First of all, what is she wearing? She's wearing something a little bit unusual. What is she wearing? Yeah?
Are you sure that's a judge's dress?
It does look like a judge's dress, doesn't it? It's not a judge's dress, no. But this is a dress that if you are in Britain, you probably only wear for one day in your lifetime. Yeah, it is when you receive your diploma from the university. Yeah, no, I didn't do it. I stayed at home. I got it through the post because I'm that kind of person. But yeah, you know how they like to dress up. In some universities in France, they're beginning to do this. I suppose it shouldn't be illegal, but you know, not my thing. So she is receiving her. So this is tremendously interesting. Because she is not known as an intellectual. In fact, she often said, "Oh, we don't need the intellectuals. There are too many intellectuals." And so it's interesting that somebody, after her death, said this is what she wanted. And secondly, it is in her hometown. It is not in London in front of the Houses of Parliament. Yeah? And that's not an accident, the places where you put it. Also, it is frequently vandalised. So, yes, yeah, so it's not consensual. It's not consensual. Perhaps in 100 years' time, people will find it more consensual. Two people left. A left-wing Labour politician, British, left-wing leader of the Labour Party from 2015 to 2020. Quite a radical gentleman. If you want to understand, if I simplify a little bit, he's a little bit the Jean-Luc Mélenchon of British politics. Yeah, that's not exactly, but very close, very close. And of course, just like Jean-Luc Mélenchon, many people love him and many people hate him. Yeah, it's a polarizing figure. He was leader of the Labour Party for 5 years, and his his approach shows how the leadership of the Labour Party in the last 50 years has gone left, right. Of course, not as right-wing as the Conservative Party, but nevertheless, it's been very, very different. Today, the leader of today's Labour Party, Keir Starmer, is probably going to expel Jeremy Corbyn from the Labour Party. Yeah, so there's a very, very big political battle going on here. And I'm sure you understand that when you get to the exam, it's not important if you think Margaret Thatcher is wonderful or horrible. There are no marks for thinking she's wonderful. There are no marks for thinking she's horrible. But you have to show you understand the debates. Yeah. Spoiler, she's horrible. Okay, right. And the very last one, Mary Lou MacDonald, Ireland. We're going over to Ireland. Born in 1969. She's nearly as old as me. Well, okay. I remember 1969. It was very boring. No internet. Le correcteur d'autographe qui a mis un accent sur président. President of Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin is an Irish political party, and it is the political party which is in favour of a united Irish Republic and the end of Northern Ireland under British control. Oof. Oh. That's all we're going to do, nothing else. Now, of course, this means we will have a kind of summary of major currents of history in Britain and America over the last 300 years. You look tired already. Yeah, it is. It's very tiring. What about me? Yeah, I have to make it up. Now, when we get to the end, then you will have your fabulous oral exam, and what you will receive. Is you will be given an extract of, you know, half a page from one of these. It will not be an extract we have studied in class. Okay? What do you have to do? Well, certainly you will try to show that you understand what they're saying. But also, you are expected to ask some of these questions. What was the situation when the document was being written? Who was this person writing it? What was their objective? What were they hoping for? Who were they talking to? Sometimes students say, the document is addressed to everybody. There are no documents which are addressed to everybody. That doesn't exist. So you have to think about, who are they writing for? How much influence did they have? Were they successful? After their speech or their document, what was the future of the question? Were they the first person to announce a big principle, which later would become very... Or on the contrary, were they defending an idea which was going to disappear? Now, you don't have to correctly answer all of those questions, but you must attempt some of them. And in fact, it is obligatory to attempt some of the questions. Even if you say, I'm not sure who they are addressing. They might be addressing this group of people, or they might be addressing this people of people. You will get some points for asking the question. If you avoid the question, that's very dangerous. Don't avoid the question. I'm sure you'll be fine. Every year, most people are fine. So that was just the general introduction. So I'm now going to give you a lot of history. So let's have a lot of history. I'm going to have to summarize the Reformation and the Enlightenment in 25 minutes. So here he is, John Locke. Incidentally, while we're at it, I recommend this book, which you can find in the library, just for the general background. Very well written, very easy to read, pretty good. Not as good as my History of Britain, but I haven't written it yet. Okay, here is the first document. The first document is this one, Epistola de Tolerantia ad Clarissimum Virum. However, we decided to work on the English translation because the Latin is rather difficult. Yeah, you see, we can be generous. The reason I put this up here is, LXXX1X, 15... I can't do it. Never mind. Oh, it doesn't correspond. He wrote it in Latin, but it was immediately translated into English. So this is interesting in itself, because for many, many years, the international language of intellectuals was Latin. When Isaac Newton got an apple falling on his head and discovered gravity, he wrote it down, I think, in his book Principia Mathematica, which was in Latin. But we are in a period now, the Enlightenment, when Latin is becoming less important and other languages more important. So here we have, it was immediately translated into English, and here we have the first edition in English, 1689. In a moment I will be telling you what is important about 1689 and what happened in the 150 years before. So a letter concerning toleration. Now, at the time when people ordered this on Amazon, they understood that toleration means religious toleration. Everybody knew that at the time. Not toleration in general, not being nice to people who have tattoos or who like jazz, but religious toleration. This is what the question is. What is the situation of religious toleration? And we can see here, 50 years later, approximately, just over 50 years later, the third edition. So it is still being published 50 years later. It was an extremely influential document, and the leaders of the American independence movement will be great fans of John Locke and the things that he says. And they will think that that's very important. In fact, in some ways, the ideas in the letter concerning toleration will be even more important for the United States. He wrote it in Britain, but in some ways these ideas will be even more important for the United States. I hope to be able to tell you about this. So, religious tolerance. Sorry, toleration. He is talking about toleration between Christians. Yeah. He is not thinking about tolerating Muslims. That's a ridiculous idea for him. No. Between Christians. Keep it serious here. What I'm going to do now is go back 150 years and summarize what has been happening to religion and to politics before 1689, so that you can see how we got to this situation. Some of these things you know, Henry VIII, Mary, Elizabeth, but you know, I think a summary might be useful. You've probably forgotten a lot of it. Because one of the difficult things is to think about religious toleration without making the standard mistake It is completely different in 1689 and today. It is not about, are you nice to Jews? Are you nice to Muslims? Or are you good to Protestants? It's not about individuals. It's about the government. Should the government put certain kinds of Protestants in prison or not? Yeah? Should we have a war about religion? At the time when he wrote, there was a huge war, I think it had just finished in Germany, between the Protestants and the Catholics. In France, the king had just decided to get rid of the Edict of Nantes. The Edict of Nantes said, oh, okay, Protestants are okay. But just before this writing, the king of France said, oh, no, let's repress the Protestants. And so this is a big, hot question at the time. But let me go back in time. I have one more picture here, which is symbolic. This is during the Civil War in the 1640s in Britain. And this is a wonderful drawing. And it's impossible to understand if you don't understand the history. These are soldiers. And they are taking away the railing in the church, which separates the altar, where the priest is, and the public. It separates them. And they're sending soldiers to take away the railings. It sounds really, really bizarre. And this is because of what I will tell you in a moment, the big conflict of the Reformation. On the one hand, the Catholics saying, the most important thing is the church. God speaks directly to the Pope. The Pope speaks to the bishop. The bishop speaks to the priests, and priests are very special people, tradition. And the new Protestants, no. What is important is your individual relationship to God. Priests are helpers, but they're not very important. We don't want any separation in the churches between the priest section and the people section. And this became a very hot issue. In fact, we're going to send soldiers to take away the railings, yes. Now, today we think, oh là là, but, oh là, une guerre sur ça, mais qu'est-ce qu'ils sont cons? Après, il faut voir si les guerres qu'on a aujourd'hui sont sur des trucs plus intelligents, c'est pas sûr. Okay, right, there you go. So let me go back in time to the Reformation. The Reformation then, which is after 1,000 years, 1,200 years, when the Catholic Church, the Christian Church, the only Christian Church, dominated Europe. Europe, which was, Europe was like a powerful place. Not the most powerful place at the beginning. In 1000, China was much more advanced in technology and so on. But by 1700, Europe is much more advanced than China. So a very important part of the world, dominated by the Christian Church. And the Reformation is the time when Protestantism came along and said, hey, let's have a different church. And the countries which will be mostly influenced by Protestantism, Britain, Germany, the United States, these are pretty powerful countries, and the countries which remained Catholic, Ireland, Italy, Spain, were important but not as powerful. France is the only exception where it remained powerful and has nuclear weapons but remained kind of Catholic. Okay, so France is a bizarre exception. Now, this revolt, this Protestant revolt of the Reformation. A revolt was not a new idea. There were often revolts against the Catholic ideas. In the 12th century in Britain, Mr. Wycliffe organized a revolt against corruption in the church. And his band translated the Bible into English. This was a terrible crime at the time. The Bible must be in Latin, because only the priests can read it, and they will tell you what you should think of it. So translating the Bible into English was to say, the Bible is for everybody, you can all read the Bible. This was a dangerous revolutionary thing to do, and he was executed, and all his friends were executed, and they lost. In France you have the Cathars who had this idea, we are all equal, and priests are not important. I'm not an expert on Cathars. And they got repressed. If you are ever lucky enough to go to Albi, the cathedral in Albi is the one that they built just after they killed the Qatar. And it's you're supposed to look at it and say, okay, you're the boss. And it is really, really, really intimidating place. So revolts against the church were not unusual. What was different for the Reformation, completely different, is they had a revolt and they won. What is different about the Reformation is not the first revolt, it's the one that won. And so, as you will be used to me saying, historians, we're always interested to know why. And the reason the reason why the Protestants won when all the other revolts lost is because the new commercial classes, especially in Germany, but also in England and in Holland, in the Netherlands, they liked Protestantism. Catholicism said the most important thing is tradition. The Pope and the King and the Bishops and the Lords and the priests and the sheriffs, and then the ordinary people. And Protestantism said, no. Everybody is important in the eyes of God. You must have your own individual relationship with God. And the hierarchy is not so important. And tradition is not the most important thing. Individual action is important. Sounds like capitalism, doesn't it? Yeah. And in fact, that is exactly the case, that the Protestant ideas fit more closely the priorities of capitalism. Individual ambition, change, expansion. Let's discover America. Let's explore. Let's colonize Australia. Let's do all these things. That's not me saying that. I think it's Weber who wrote a book called Protestantism and the Spirit of Capitalism. That's not the exact title. But the new commercial classes liked these new ideas. Also, the church was a very powerful, a very, very rich competitor in commerce. And the church didn't pay any taxes. So there were many reasons for it. So if we look at Britain, I've given you the list of monarchs, just because the actual process was very slow and a little bit complicated. Henry VIII was the first one. He's the famous one, you know, the fat guy with loads of wives. He was thin when he was young. Tell me about it. He should have done a bit more jogging. He would have been fine. And so he had a conflict with the Pope. Nothing new here. And he wanted a son, so he said to the Pope, can you cancel my marriage, please? Can you cancel my marriage, please? Normally the Pope would say yes. Cancelling marriages was not a new idea. But the Pope and the King were in conflict. The church was too powerful for the King. And so the King revolted and said, oh no, I reject the Pope and I am now the King of the Church in England. Notez bien qu'il n'a pas dit the Church of England, but the Church in England, because he did not want to change the ideas of the Church, just change the boss. Henry VIII was really not a Protestant. At this time, inside the Church, there were Protestant ideas, and inside the Church, there were Catholic ideas, but they hadn't separated yet. I don't want to give you too many details. When Henry died, the next king was surrounded by people who were really Protestants. And under Edward, the church in England became the Church of England, a Protestant church. Henry had already taken all the gold of the church. So, I'm the boss now, so I will take all your gold. Close all the monasteries, give me the gold. The monasteries have billions of dollars, approximately, in land. I will give all this land to my friends. This will make me new friends. Always useful when you're a king. After Edward, we have a Protestant Church of England. Lady Jane Grey was a very unhappy lady because when Edward died, they said, oh, Jane should be king. Jane should be queen. And then 3 days later, she was executed because somebody didn't agree. She said, yes, I want to be queen. Sometimes you need to keep your mouth shut, you know. So it's just one of those times. Okay. So Mary became queen. She was the granddaughter of one of the other kings. Yes, they all had. It was all a big family. But Mary was a Catholic. So Mary said, "Hey, we're changing this. The Protestant Church, I don't like this. We are again. I'm writing to the Pope, dear Pope. We want you to be boss again." However, Mary was not stupid, and so Mary said, "We are now a Catholic Church again. However, all the land and gold which you took from the church, you can keep it." It's practical politics. Yeah, she couldn't take it back. However, she was unlucky, and she only lived for 5 more years. Dying was a very popular activity at the time. And Elizabeth was luckier, because Elizabeth had 50 years, and her job was to stabilize the Church of England. When Henry said, "I'm the boss," this released a whole wave of new ideas. Lots of groups said, "Hey, so the Pope is not so important. I have some ideas for a new religion as well." "Oh, so do I." 100 different groups saying, "Oh, religion should be like this. No, religion should be like that." And so Elizabeth's idea was to try to stabilize the situation. Kill a few Catholics, kill a few extreme Protestants. But mostly she would be pretty intelligent, and she would say, certain differences are not so important. I will come to this in a moment. So she produced the Church of England as it is today, where in fact you can have quite a variety of religious opinions inside it. If you're in England today and you go into a Church of England church, one church will be, it looks like a Catholic church, statues and crosses and gold. And you go into another Church of England church and it will look like a Methodist chapel. No statues, no decorations, very, very simple. The priest is called Freddy. And so inside the Church of England, it is what we call a broad church. They are not strict about following exactly the same rituals, and I will come back to that. So Elizabeth stabilized the situation, but her following kings were more sympathetic to Catholicism and also more sympathetic to absolutism. Because James I and Charles I were saying, look at France. That's a Catholic country. And the King of France, yeah. He has real power. I can't remember which Louis it was, but it was one of those with a big number and Versailles. Yeah. And so the idea of Catholic ideas and absolutist ideas went together. And so James and I said, "Yeah, well, we don't want to share power with Parliament, and we want to go back to the Catholic ideas, because the Catholic ideas are the ideas of those countries where the king is really powerful. That's what we want." This was not a great success. After Charles, we have the Civil War. Charles is executed. The English executed their king 140 years before the French. Yes, pour une fois les Anglais l'ont fait en premier. So that is the main situation before the Civil War, and I will continue in a moment. But let's have a look at the ideas, the most important ideas of the Reformation I already mentioned, but I will come back to them. Firstly, against corruption in the church. Secondly, the most important one, I think, for a personal relationship with God. And the commercial classes love this. And so, if you have a personal relationship with God, then the priest is not so important. Because the old Catholic idea, the Pope has the mobile phone number of God. Yeah, and so, direct communication with God. And the Pope talks to the bishop, and the bishop talks to the priest, and the priest is always right. It's the old idea. But, you must read the Bible and think about it for yourselves, is the Protestant idea. And so, less separation between the priests and the others. So, for the Protestants, it's okay if priests get married. Yeah? Whereas for the Catholics, the priest is too special a person, must not get married. One example of this idea that priests should or should not be different is transubstantiation. Est-ce qu'il y a d'autres gens ici qui ont eu une éducation religieuse à part moi? Vous vous rappelez ce que c'est? Vous avez le droit, hein? Si vous vous confessez, ça ira. Okay. Yeah. Transubstantiation. It's what happens on a Sunday. As you know, on a Sunday, the priest says, "Yeah, here is the bread, and here is the blood, and let's remember Jesus Christ because he was a cool guy." Yeah. Okay. Now, in a Catholic church and a Protestant church, it is completely different. In a Protestant church, they do this. This is a symbolic celebration of Jesus. That's what Protestants say. It's a symbol, like a Christmas tree, you know. In a Catholic church, not at all. In a Catholic church, what happens is that the priest carries out a miracle and the bread is transformed. It is no longer bread. It is the body of Christ. This is transubstantiation. Now, of course, if the priest carries out a miracle every Sunday, he is completely different from ordinary people. And so he must not get married. He must wear special clothes, etc., etc. And so, although this appears to be a detail, it's not a detail if you're in there. And the last one is very similar. For the Catholics, the Pope is always right when he is speaking about religion. He is always right because he asked God's opinion and God tells him. Okay? And for the Protestants, no. Each individual has a personal relationship with God, etc. So these are the big ideas. This change to the Reformation, this change to Protestant ideas, was a huge transformation of Europe. And just to show you how much they thought of it, I, again, travelling, I went to Geneva, not specially for this class, you know, I was just there. And this is the monument to the Reformation in Geneva. It is actually 100 metres long. Here you have the four fathers of the Reformation: John Knox, who is Scottish, I can't remember the other, Calvin, who is Swiss, I think. These are four theologians who brought up these new ideas. And as you can see, the people in Geneva thought they were wonderful. These are enormous statues. They thought they were wonderful. The slogan of the town of Geneva, Post Tenebras Lux. Après l'obscurité est arrivée la lumière. Huh? Il se prenait pas pour de la merde, quoi. Okay? This is the Reformation. The light is Protestant ideas, science, modernization, commerce. You know, Geneva is famous for banking. Yeah, banking is perhaps the new god. Yeah. A huge transformation. However, it was not, what was not common was toleration. Toleration is the idea that, you know, the government, it's fine. You have some religious opinions, you have another, it's not a problem. And that was not so popular. For example, when Mary was queen, Mary famously has the nickname Bloody Mary because she liked to burn Protestants. It has to be said. I was brought up a Catholic, yeah, so I have prejudices against Protestants, but you know, I don't normally burn them. Well, not recently. Okay, so here you have a picture. This is from Fox's Book of Martyrs, which is a Protestant book, an extremely popular Protestant book in the 18th and 19th century. If people in England had two books, the Bible and Fox's Book of Martyrs. And here you can see the burning of Protestants. And according to the story, one of the women was pregnant, and while she was burning, she had birth to the baby. You can see the baby. And then the soldiers threw the baby back into the fire, and everybody had a lot of fun. Now, this is no doubt Protestant propaganda. Yeah, it looks like, we don't know, but you know, it looks like it could easily be Protestant propaganda. So let's say that toleration was not at the centre of English life at the time. Now, although Mary is known as Bloody Mary, in fact, Elizabeth also killed a number of Catholics. Okay, Elizabeth killed 200 Catholics in 50 years, and Mary killed 300 Protestants in 5 years. So, okay. And here you have celui-là, c'est une erreur parce qu'en fait il est mort un siècle plus tard. C'est celui-là. Edmund Campion is one of the Catholic martyrs under Elizabeth. I went to a Catholic school, and we had to sing a song about we want to be a martyr too. Really? Yeah, so, how sweet would be thy children's fate if they like them could die for thee. You know, like, I'm 8 years old, I'm going, just a moment here. You know, let's not be a martyr if that's okay. Yeah? So it's all very bloody. When I was young, there was still quite a lot of conflict between Catholics and Protestants in Britain. And I wouldn't have liked to bring home a Protestant girlfriend. That would have been a problem. Of course, if you bring home a Muslim girlfriend, then my parents would say, yes, but is she a Catholic Muslim or a Protestant Muslim? Yeah. This is a joke, but not quite a joke. You know, it's really, we did really see the world a bit like that. Just another couple of illustrations of the religious conflict. In 1603, when James I became king, yeah, Elizabeth had been in the middle. Yeah, some Protestant ideas are okay, some traditional ideas are okay, but not Catholics. And when James came along, the more extreme Protestants, the more radical Protestants, said, "Yeah, now is the time to change things." And these were two of the things which the more radical Protestants hated. Of course, the vestments, because you know these clothes show that the priest is different from everybody else. So they hated that. And they also hated these, a wedding ring. Yeah, I know it's on the wrong finger, arthritis. They hated this because it's not in the Bible. There are no wedding rings in the Bible. It is a pagan tradition, pre-Christian tradition. So the Protestant, no. Only what is in the Bible must count. So they're just a couple of examples there. So, we got the executed king. So we're now in 1649, only 40 years before the document, but I wanted to explain all that context of what, you know, what religious toleration was about. And so we have the Civil War, and the winner of the Civil War is the more radical Protestants under the leadership of Oliver Cromwell. There is his statue in front of the House of Parliament. For 11 years, England was a republic. They didn't use the word republic, they used the word commonwealth. But it's a very similar word, really, because republic, res publica, la chose publique. Commonwealth, la richesse commune. La chose publique, la richesse commune. It's about the same thing. Cromwell and his friends were not successful in stabilizing a new system of government without the king. And so, a few years later, they had a new idea, and a whole section of the elite, after Oliver Cromwell had died, the whole section of the elite, they wrote a letter to the son of the executed king. And they said, "Will you please come back and be king again?" Now, as you can imagine, the son said, "Yes." Il savait pas faire un autre métier. So he said yes. However, and then we have the restoration of the monarchy, and Britain has a king again. So if you look at it superficially, you think, "Oh, well, it's back to the old system." This is absolutely not the case. One scholar at the time said, "What has been written by the sword cannot be eliminated by the pen." The Parliament said to the future king, "Come back and be king, but we are the boss and you are not the boss." Indeed, a few years later, the Parliament passed a law saying the king will receive a salary from the Parliament. Now, if you receive a salary, you're not boss. Yeah. So complete difference. After 1660, the restoration, you have the modern English monarchy. less and less power until you get people like the king today, who has no power, no ideas, no nothing. Although he has a problem with Charles, because King Charles today, he has a personality. In many jobs, this is an advantage, but if you're king, that's a real disadvantage. And so he's going to have some problems, but he probably won't be executed, unfortunately. Okay, so the restoration. What's more, when the king, not this one, but the next one, his brother, I think, began to make decisions which the Parliament didn't like, the Parliament sacked him. This is James II. Oh, sorry, not that one. Oh, no, I don't have a picture of him. Yeah. The Parliament was unhappy with the king, so they sacked him. They really literally sacked him. What they did is they wrote to William in the Netherlands and said, will you please invade our country and become king? And so William arrived with a very small army. And James II got his army and went to meet William. And he had a bad day, did James II, because his sister joined William. Faut jamais se fier de ses sœurs, franchement. Can you imagine, you go, oh, let's have a war to defend my crown. Oh dear, my sister's on the other side. Okay. Anyway, James gave up and ran away to France. And the new king, William, and the Queen Mary, were chosen by Parliament. So this is a proof that after 1660, the Parliament was the boss and not the rest. And it is only 1 year later that this document is written, this document of John Locke. Okay, ça fait beaucoup de contexte, mais bon, qu'est-ce que vous voulez? The main point I would want to make here is that at this time, or before this time, religion and politics are the same thing. Now, that sounds really bizarre to modern people. But before, in the 16th and 17th century, religion and politics are the same thing. Everybody believes in God. And if you are a radical and you want a new society, you say, God wants a new society. And if you are a traditionalist and you want the society not to change, you say, God wants society not to change. So religion is politics. John Locke is suggesting that there should be more separation between religion and politics. We have a little bit of key vocabulary here on the first page. Commonwealth, he uses the word in this document, he uses the word Commonwealth. It's not the Commonwealth, I just mentioned the English Republic under Cromwell. It's not the Commonwealth today, which is a soft power British organisation of ex-colonies. It's just a general word for society, the society. He uses the word magistrates. And he uses this to mean the boss, the government, the person who decides. So when he says the magistrate, he means the government. And toleration. When he says toleration, he does not mean smiling at people and shaking their hand and being friendly to them. He means not putting them in prison. And so what he is saying is that Christians... Or I should say, Protestants who have a different idea about the importance of the priest or the importance of baptism or the government should not interfere. This is John Locke's idea. The government should not interfere. If you are a Protestant but you have different ideas, that's fine. And indeed, John Locke's view was there is one true religion, but we don't know which one it is. He did not believe, he's not a modern, he's not a 21st century liberal. Today you hear people saying, either they're saying all religions are bad or all religions are good. This is not John Locke. He thinks there is only one good religion, but we have no way of being sure which one it is. And when he says the government should not worry about whether you believe in adult baptism and you believe in infant baptism. This is a real discussion. The government should not put you in prison. That's what John Locke is saying. And this is quite a new idea. At this time, this is quite a new idea. That's what's important about it. Now, I was mentioning that this idea was probably even more important in the United States, because many of the English people who went to the United States to become colonists, they went for religious reasons. They went to the North in New England because they felt that they were more radical Protestants, and they didn't like the way that radical Protestants were treated in England, and so they went to the New World, and separate groups of Protestants made separate colonies. And there were three or four colonies in the North, all different religion. And then in Maryland it was the Catholics who came when they were unhappy in England. Maryland is named after Queen Mary, the Catholic Queen of England. And Pennsylvania was established by William Penn, the Quaker leader. So many people came to it was not yet the United States. Many people came to America for religious reasons. And so when the United States of America was established, it was essential that they say the government is neutral about your religion. It was essential. Otherwise, it was impossible to have the United States of America. Okay, so let's have a look at the document. I want you to take a little bit of time and just now read the first page while I have a rest.